You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Setlist, we'll hear from the Iowa singer-songwriter Lissy, who stopped by the WPR studio to play a set of songs from her latest album and talk about her renewed passion for making music on her own terms. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, from the latest court action on Wisconsin voting laws to the federal government's big cheese. Robert Menster is back with us. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start, Rob, with voting in Wisconsin. We've seen a lot of back and forth in the courts about various voting laws in Wisconsin. A voter ID gets a lot of the attention, but there's news this week about early voting. What happened in the courts?
Yeah, we have talked about the sort of the whiplash-inducing on-again, off-again rulings on voter ID. And in fact, it's worth mentioning just this afternoon, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court has refused to reinstate the voter ID law. And so that's the latest breaking news this afternoon, that it looks like voter ID will indeed be in place for November. But on early voting, we got what certainly looks like a definitive final answer earlier this week, and that is early voting is on. There had been a law passed by Wisconsin Republicans that early voting couldn't start until October 24th. And that was thrown out as part of the ruling in July that also upheld some of the voter ID requirements. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel appealed that, and on Monday he lost that appeal, and on Tuesday he said he would not be taking that any further. So that is that. You can go vote early.
And that's for this election. He was looking for a stay pending further consideration. Is that right?
Right. That's right. That's exactly. And so that's for this election. Early voting is something that takes some pressure off of polling places on election day, especially given the long lines that we saw in the presidential primary. This is, it may well be the case that this makes it easier to vote for people who maybe don't have such flexible work hours or who have trouble getting out on Tuesday. And of course, the other big thing that that early voting does is it allows sort of committed partisan activists to hold early voting events to vote themselves and then drive around on election day and do get out the vote stuff.
As I understand it, this law didn't just affect when early voting could start, but also where it could happen. It limited municipalities to one early voting site, which part of the challenge was, well, if you're talking about a larger city, especially like, say, Milwaukee, that's restrictive, the plaintiff said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are a lot of rural places where there is one polling place. It's pretty obvious that in a larger city, that's not the case. And so, there were a number of things: the time limits and no voting the weekend before the election, and restrictions on in-person absentee ballots. It all sort of winnowed down the opportunities to cast these votes outside of election day, and a lot of that stuff is now thrown out.
So with all the back and forth, Rob, let me make sure I've got it right here. Voter ID, yes, we need voter ID to vote in November's elections. And cities, municipalities, whatever, can have early voting starting in September at the sites of their choosing.
That's right. Some places like Milwaukee and Madison, the largest cities, have said that they're likely to begin early voting probably in the last week of September. Not every place has it all set up, and different cities, different municipalities have some leeway on when they'll do that. But we're going to start to get details on that now that we have clarity on the law.
Pending some really big court surprise, but probably now it's too late for that.
Who knows, right? Yeah.
We're talking to Rob Menster from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin this week. And Rob, another story you've been watching, a lot of the country has been watching, the story of the defendants featured in the Making a Murderer Netflix series. Some news today on Stephen Avery, some new tests that his lawyer wants. But his nephew, Brendan Dassey, had his conviction overturned, maybe released or headed to a new trial. And you've been watching, I know, the reaction to this. What are you seeing this week?
Yes, we saw the we heard in the news at the top of the hour the claims made by Stephen Avery's lawyer and the process that they're engaging in. But to me, what may be more interesting or may end up having more impact are ripple effects from the Brendan Dassey case. Of course, Dassey was convicted of being a party to he was convicted of murder for being a party to Avery's crime, and Dassey was just 16 at the time of the murder. And for those millions of people who were captivated by the Netflix series Making a Murderer, those sequences, that's some of the hardest parts to watch were the interrogations of Dassey, because he was so young and because he had some mental limitations and he clearly didn't understand what was going on in cases. So that's why it was on exactly those grounds that his conviction was overturned, and now prosecutors have to decide whether or not they're going to retry him. So what we saw this week, at any rate, a couple of our USA Today Network Wisconsin reporters surveyed some experts in juvenile justice. There was one of the policy changes that at least one expert saw potentially coming of this could be a requirement that juveniles have a lawyer present during interrogation. That is a key part of what the judge said in this case. And so with the conviction overturned in a high-profile case, it could be that this ends up having some impact.
Yeah, so a lot of what I think attracted people to this series was the particulars of the case. But this could lead to wider policy changes, legal changes, as you say, when it comes to young suspects, interrogations, and legal representation. This could have a spill-out effect way beyond this particular case.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the prosecutors may retry Dassey. He may be convicted again. We don't know what will happen, but I do think that it's the sort of message that gets heard when something that has this much attention on it gets overturned.
We'll keep on watching that. I know you will. And finally, the federal government is buying cheese, lots and lots of cheese. I think the number I saw was 11 million pounds of cheese. What's going on, Rob?
Yeah, we may have overdone it with the cheese. So back in May, the Wall Street Journal reported that there was so much surplus cheese in America that every man, woman, and child in the country would need to eat an extra 3 pounds this year to work through that surplus, which I say, listen, I think we can do it. Who says Americans can't set big goals and achieve them? I think we can band together and eat those 3 pounds of cheese. But this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that it would buy $20 million worth of cheese, distributed to food pantries, food banks around the country. And the idea is that this will help to boost prices for dairy farmers and keep excess stores of cheese from going to waste, which is what is bound to happen.
And then, and then the markets, the foreign markets, might pick back up and reduce this glut, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so the U.S. dollar is high right now, and so it's less attractive to foreign markets, and Europe is producing more milk, so that also is eating into U.S. exports. So, these things are cyclical. The reason that there's a glut now is because people increased production when there was a higher demand. So it could come back, but yeah, it shows. This year at least, and for the last couple years, dairy producers have overshot.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Rob Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. We continue our summer music series set list. Today, the Iowa singer-songwriter Lissy recently stopped by WPR to perform a set of songs in our studio. She talked to Veronica Rickert about her renewed passion for making music on her own terms.
Lissy, thank you so much for coming into the studio and performing today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about your new album. It's called My Wild West. Where did that one come from for you?
Well, I had started kind of just working on some songs in general to make a new album, and they were almost sort of predictive, the songs I was writing, that I was ready for a change. And so I ended up making the decision to leave Southern California, where I'd been for 12 years, and move back to the Midwest. And making this album, I think, was almost like a you know, processing that decision and sort of reflecting on the years I spent West. So it's, you know, not, I wouldn't say a concept album, but definitely like a way for me to sort of process and work through this decision to like leave glorious California, you know, to come home.
How many years were you in California?
12 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And I didn't really know that I was going to leave necessarily. It was like kind of had been brewing, I think, or bubbling under the surface for some time.
I know I'm going to see you again. Now I'll keep thinking of you until then. Oh, hi.
It wasn't just leaving Southern California. It sounds like you were also signed on a major label out there, and you were confronting some personal stuff going on that you were discovering. Maybe you weren't having fun anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I had been on Columbia out of the UK, out of London, for a good many years, and I got a lot accomplished with them, and for the most part, it was a pretty good situation. I spent a lot of time touring in Europe, and, you know, my first album went gold in the UK and in Norway, and you know, I'm lucky now I have a kind of career where I can go over to Norway and play some summer dates and make a good living that way. But I just was, you know, I got dropped after my second album, which is pretty normal. I wasn't worried about it. I was ready to be free again. And I sort of guessed that you had to, you know, go into the studio and like record some more songs and work with this person and, you know, get an A&R guy from some label to tell you if it's any good or not and then get signed again and then like wait to put it out. And I just sort of hit this point where I was like, I don't really care anymore. Like, I know I like to sing. I can always drive around and with my dog who's here today, like, you know, and just play acoustic and probably be able to at least like afford to live. So it sort of was like a me confronting and like accepting like music for me isn't about fame and fortune. It's about, you know, sharing and enjoying myself. And when that had stopped, I realized I needed to sort of change my situation so that music wasn't ruined for me. You know, it's my happy place. I wanted to keep it that.
So you had those 12 years in L.A. What was it like being a Midwesterner in L.A.?
Well, you know, I left Rock Island, Illinois when I was 18, and I went to Colorado for a couple years. And then I actually went and did a semester in Paris, which was a huge culture shock. So that sort of, I think, prepared me to then, you know, when I was 21, moved to L.A., didn't really know anyone, didn't know the city. I think I was pretty, like, rebellious, though, and naive, too, when I was young. So it was actually, like, pretty awesome. I just threw myself into it. I mean, had way too much fun, met a lot of crazy people, was in all sorts of surreal situations where I was with, like, you know, celebrities and singing at celebrity weddings and places where I never felt like I really fit in, but it was almost like cool just to say I did it. But I mean, I didn't really feel understood or like I fit in high school, which I think is just a pretty typical, like, you know, hormonal coming of age thing that a lot of people go through no matter where they live. But it's funny how my perception of the Midwest was that it was like a place that didn't get me and never would, and I had to get out and like go to the city. And I think coming into my 30s, I realized how wrong I was about what I thought of the Midwest and how much I missed it, and which is why I moved back. I grew up, you know, Swedish Lutheran. I think there's kind of a wholesomeness that I didn't really think I have. I think of myself as like a rebel, but really I'm kind of more naive than I realized. But I think Midwesterners are cool because I think they're down to earth, they're friendly, I think they're able to prioritize. Like, I don't really know that I know anyone that seems super materialistic, or, you know, it's sort of like a good-hearted approach to life. And so, yes, I did get comments from people like out in the world of like, wow, you're a Midwesterner, or they make fun of my accent, which I never thought I had until I went into the world.
Oh, Addy River, the Mississippi. Oh, all the troubles your banks have seen.
And you're really putting down roots. It sounds like you bought a farm.
I did, yeah, and I'm in totally over my head. But
what is that like? It's
beautiful. I mean, it's a new adventure. I have a lot to learn. I just also got another 37 acres this past week that's connected to mine. And, you know, I think I'm a little, I've been using the word naive a lot, but like romanticizing this idea of farming, but it is hard work. And I have no plan to really grow corn or soybeans or to like make my living from farming. So I think I'll rent my tillable acreage until I figure out if I can go into like a conservation program, CRP, try to grow like a habitat for pollinators. There's programs you can get into, but I haven't really been there enough to see what it's going to be like. But, you know, I definitely feel like sitting on the porch with my guitar a lot.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And you can hear there's nature in your music. You've got a song called Oh Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everyone's heard of the Mississippi River. It's like any time we drove over the bridge from Illinois to Iowa, because the Quad Cities is sort of like one big town that's on both sides of the river. And my dad would always say, oh, the mighty Mississippi, and like this legendary power and strength. And it's dangerous, you know, and it's intense and it's moody and it's really just it's beautiful in its unpredictability and strength. And, you know, I wanted to write about it. So I did.
Lift up the please, as you flow past, oh, witness river, you've seen it all.
I was reading a little bit about, again, some of your time away from the Midwest, and that you got hit with a wave of anxiety at one point. You didn't know it was anxiety, you just, what was going on? And I'm curious how that might have changed after some of the changes that you've made now. What was it like for you being in the middle of that, and what is it like now?
Well, I kind of knew I was maybe having a panic attack, but in my mind I thought everything was okay, but like my chest was so tight and for so many days that I was like, am I going to have a heart attack? Like, do I have cancer? Like, I was thinking it was physical, that there must be something physically wrong with me. Went to the hospital and they said, no, this is anxiety. We see it every day. It's very normal. But yeah, it was at the beginning of 2015. I was actually in the recording studio. The producer I was working with left, like didn't like any of my songs. I felt like everyone was looking to me to know what was next. And it just sort of, that and some other things that were going on just culminated. And I ended up having this big anxiety attack that led to very impulsively, quickly after that, was like, I'm done. I'm moving back to the Midwest. I'm going to buy something like a farm in Iowa. I'm going to break up with my band. I'm going to just like play acoustic shows. I'm going to simplify my life.
Did the fixes work?
I think so. I mean, I still get anxious. I just recognize it for what it is, and you can't really listen to, like, the, you know, loop sometimes that we all have going on in our heads. It's like you can almost detach yourself from it. And then I went to Fairfield, Iowa, and I, like, had taken, like, a 5-day transcendental meditation course, and I feel like as long as I try to exercise and do that when I can, it kind of helps me stay a little calmer and more able to, like, handle things that come my way.
And you keep on
also involved in a charity, it sounds like, that helps women in Africa access clean water. What is the charity and how did you get involved?
Yeah, well, it's a really brilliant nonprofit. It's called Charity Water. They have their own, like, private fund of, like, people who cover all their costs, so that literally every penny goes right to building wells. And they have, like, these GPS, like, monitored, like, online wells, so you can see how much water they're pumping. If they break, there's a team that goes and fixes them. So it's a brilliant company that actually my lawyer is involved with. And so I wrote this song, Daughters, which is more generally just a song about women sticking up for themselves and, you know, acknowledging that we still have a long way to go for equality. And I think it's something like 40 billion hours in Africa alone, women are walking to get water. It's in a lot of third world developing countries, it's women's job to get the water. And that could mean walking all day long to bring back one, you know, as much water as you can carry. And so the idea is that you empower women when you give them, you know, easy access to water, because then they can go to school or they can start businesses. They can become the water managers and be leaders in their community. So that was just kind of a no-brainer when we got together. I thought, hey, I'd love to help out any way I can. And so my lovely, you know, fans and listeners donated. And if anyone, I don't know why anyone wants to listen to me, but if they do, then I'm going to talk about things that I think are important and are going to help make the world a better place.
I could have been helping, I could have been bluffing, could have been all these things. And if I am unable, tell them that I'll try underneath the table.
Before we say goodbye, you brought your dog into the studio. It seems like he's used to traveling. He's sitting in your lap right now.
He wants to get out, though, but he like just puked a minute ago for some reason, so I'm afraid to let him loose in your studio.
Does he always travel with you?
No, he doesn't, sadly. He's 10 now. I've had him since he was tiny, and you know, he stays with family mostly when I'm on the road. But since I've moved closer, you know, I'm in Northeast Iowa, so I'm only a few hours away. So since I'm close, I'm like, well, I'll just bring him with me, and I'm going to go see some family in Milwaukee after this. And he's pretty good. He sits in the case. It's really cute.
Yeah, he's really,
really
mellow.
Cute.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'm holding him like a little baby, but he tries to struggle away from my love sometimes. I force him to let me hug him.
Well, I'm glad I got to meet him, and you too. Thank you so much for coming in, Lissy.
You're very welcome. Very nice meeting you, and hopefully I'll see you again soon.
That was the Iowa singer-songwriter Lissy. You can catch her live October 5th at the Cedar Cultural Center in Minneapolis. Next week will be our final episode of Setlist this summer. We'll feature the Appleton country soul band Dusk. Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. Find more about the artists on Setlist with songs and exclusive videos over at WPR.org/setlist. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. In addition to looking at the ongoing presidential campaign, Ken talks to the author of a new book on the history of crying. They look at tears in American political history. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, since the Affordable Care Act was signed into law back in 2010, tens of millions of Americans have added health care coverage, some through reforms that allowed people to stay on their parents' insurance, and many uninsured people were able to purchase insurance through the public exchanges. The ACA, also popularly known as Obamacare, has faced a number of challenges, from a disastrous website rollout to challenges argued before the Supreme Court. The most recent issue facing the Affordable Care Act is news that several insurance companies, including insurance giants Aetna and United Health, are planning on pulling plans on public exchanges in 2017 in many states, saying they're losing money on the exchanges. Joining us to talk about that news and the overall state of the Affordable Care Act is Tom Oliver. He's a professor of population health services at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start off with a listen to President Obama talking about the Affordable Care Act. He's talking about the exchanges here back in 2010.
Once this reform is implemented, health insurance exchanges will be created, a competitive marketplace where uninsured people and small businesses will finally be able to purchase affordable quality insurance. They will be able to be part of a big pool and get the same good deal that members of Congress get. That's what's going to happen under this reform.
So, Tom, the exchanges were just part of this big, new, at the time, healthcare law. But looking at the exchanges, the healthcare marketplace, how successful has this been so far?
Well, it's a mixed record, in part because at first there was, as you pointed out, a very bumpy rollout. But actually, as time has gone on, more Americans have decided to enter and enroll in the health insurance exchanges than expected. There are, as you said, well over 10 million, 12, 13 million Americans now getting their coverage on their own through the exchanges with multiple options in general. The stumbles that we've seen in the news recently are due to the fact that some health insurance plans that have participated in the past now suggest that they will not participate. But we need to put that in perspective, I think.
What kind of perspective do you want to see that in?
Well, first of all, the plans are getting somewhat sicker than expected individuals enrolling. The thing for insurance to work, you need to get younger and healthier individuals to go along with older and sicker individuals. And to make money, you have to be able to understand what those risks will be. The risks are a little bit higher than were expected for many of the plans, in part because the rest of the insurance system has not unraveled as was expected. A lot of employers were expected to drop their coverage now that the exchanges were available and just send their workers to those exchanges. But fewer employers have dropped coverage than expected, and so some of the healthier individuals have stayed in those pools. Also, as you said, the young adults up to age 26 can stay on their parents' coverage. They tend to be very low cost and low risk and therefore are pretty profitable, but they have not entered the exchanges either. So the bad news for some of the health plans participating in the exchanges is actually due to the good news that the health system as a whole has been stabilized and is performing rather well.
I want to turn to a New York Times map earlier this month, I think it was, or last month, showing a decent chunk of the country, and I think this is something like 17% of people served in exchanges, are only going to have one or two options for healthcare providers. This is a part of Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin in particular. Most of the state has three or more options, but there's a decent portion of the country where if you want to be on this individual marketplace, you've got one choice or maybe two choices. Is this a problem that's going to go away?
It may or may not go away. I mean, the issue of having limited choice is something that is there because of the nature that there's not organized health plans in most rural areas in the United States. This is a problem not just for people who want to be on the exchanges, but for those under Medicare and other areas where there's options. So Wisconsin is actually amazing in that it has more health plans available in the exchanges than any other state except New York. In other words, more than in California, more in Texas, more than other states with much larger populations. And so part of this is that it's very difficult to create and organize health plans and health systems that then can compete and on a for-profit basis in rural America. So that is why Medicare, when it was being reformed a decade ago, the Republicans who proposed the reforms could not take away the public option and make people join private health plans because private health plans simply refused to operate in many of the rural areas.
Talking to Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on the Affordable Care Act, some big companies saying, hey, we're dropping out of markets in the individual marketplace in some states, looking at the overall health of the program. Tom, you mentioned that public option in terms of, I think it was the Medicare context. Some people are saying the solution to this, these no competition areas where there's only one or two providers, is to return to that early idea that was proposed with the Affordable Care Act of some kind of public option, some kind of Medicare-like option for people who can't get onto or can't get affordable coverage from the current companies under the exchanges. Do you think that's a viable option?
It is certainly on the table and may well be, depending on the outcome of the election in November in terms of the makeup of Congress and who's sitting in the White House. This is a long-standing problem. We've had for decades in Medicare and more recently in the Children's Health Insurance Program a lot of private health plans that are an option. And when times are good and they're making money, they come in. And when they're not making money, they want to drop out. And so a lot of individuals and families are forced to switch to other plans and change the hospitals and doctors they can use and so forth. So it's really a bigger philosophical question of whether we want to rely so heavily on private health insurance in our healthcare system, or whether a public option as a backup, similar to Medicare, but for folks under age 65, is a good idea. And then let them compete, let private insurers compete against the public option, which tends to run on much lower administrative expenses, doesn't need to pay off shareholders, and so forth.
Another solution I've seen floated is the idea that, well, Aetna, some of these big companies, they're old school. They're kind of dinosaurs. They're used to doing things in the old way. We'll have new, nimble companies coming up with fresh ways to provide affordable health care. Hopefully, that will bring those younger people on board, too. Is that happening? And are there ways that the health care laws can be tweaked to make it easier for new entries into the marketplace?
That's a very, very good question. It is so difficult because of the capital that is necessary to be raised to build health plans, to have enough risk margins, you know, to build up safety margins and reserves. And in fact, some of the smaller health plans that people thought would be successful competitors to these larger insurers have not done well under the Affordable Care Act and are struggling or even have shut down. So it would take a specific act of Congress, I think, and the president to really create some new startup funds and to support the development of these smaller health plans. On the other hand, again, here, history in Wisconsin itself, we have many, many small regional health plans that have organized and are successfully competing very, very well. So once you get them up and running, they tend to attract a lot of loyalty and do a very good job on especially the not-for-profit plans. But that is not something that's easy to do across the country as a whole.
As I understand it, at some point in Affordable Care Act negotiations in Congress, there was an idea of something called a risk corridor where the federal government would, in a way, guarantee these health care providers, hey, if you have this rocky start, you have these shortfalls, you're losing money for a while, we'll help you out. That got knocked out in the back and forth. Is that something that could be brought back that might help keep some of these companies or bring new companies into the market exchange?
That's a great point, Rob. It's actually still in the law. It's just that Congress has not provided the funds allowed under the Affordable Care Act to compensate the health plans that spent more because they enrolled sicker than expected patients. So it's really up to Congress to put the money in to help stabilize these pools. And when a health plan legitimately is spending more money going out the door than they're taking in because the patients are sicker than expected, that should be taken care of. But until Congress gets its fiscal house in order and appropriates those funds, we'll be stuck with that situation. And that is a problem for several of these plans.
We're talking about the Affordable Care Act and recent news that some insurance companies, most recently Aetna, are removing insurance plans from the public marketplace in some states. Tom Oliver is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this news? Are you getting coverage via the federal exchange? How has that worked for you? Do you have options? Do you have viable options for your bank account? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about the state of the public health insurance exchanges, especially as companies like Aetna threaten to pull their plans off the marketplace in some states. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, or your experiences getting coverage or not under the public exchange. How has the Affordable Care Act affected you and your coverage? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom Oliver is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we'll go to our callers now. Jackie is with us in Madison. Jackie, hi.
Hi there. I'm very much very happy that you're having this subject on because it's been something I've been wondering about for several months. this year, my daughter went on the exchanges. She's not covered by health care in by her in her place of business, she's found that there are high deductibles on the most affordable plans. She decided to take up a silver, was able to afford that, but still, after doing that, I think her deductible is $1,500, which is almost impossible for her to reach. And so I was wondering what's in the cards regarding that as far as the federal government changing that, or maybe the insurance companies themselves changing that. The other thing is, even if she has gone to doctors and she's gotten prescriptions of things that were very helpful for her, enabling her to work, and found that the drugs were not covered, and the drugs were so expensive, she couldn't afford them anyway.
Jackie, thanks for the call. So 2 points there, worries over high deductibles, Tom, even in that silver level plan.
Yeah, you know, the thing in our healthcare system these days is coverage is not first dollar for virtually anybody. And Jackie, you make a great point about there still being a very significant deductible. That's a pretty common deductible across most employer-based plans as well these days. The only thing I can say is I'm glad, as your daughter has experienced, to not have to spend that $1,500 because you're lucky enough to be healthy. To not give money to the healthcare system is good for you, and even if it feels painful in terms of how much money you're putting in and not getting a lot out. The drugs are also an interesting question because some of the very, very high expensive ones do then translate into high deductibles that patients have to get. And so some who have very limited income or discretionary income after paying rent and food and other transportation needs are ending up splitting their pills or going without entirely. And that is a problem. And that's something that is going to have to continue to be discussed. What is actually affordable? There are a lot of subsidies for lower and middle income individuals to buy this insurance, but they're still left with these very high deductibles, and especially in the plans that are cheaper than the one that Jackie's daughter purchased. So this is going to be a conversation that will never go away, honestly, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or our negotiations with employers.
Jackie, thanks for the call. Good luck to your daughter. We'll go to Sarah next in Holman. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been following this conversation with Aetna particularly closely because of an NPR article that referred to a Huffington Post investigation stating that Aetna had sent a memo to the Justice Department basically saying, if you don't approve our merger with Humana, we're going to pull out of the exchange plans. And I'd like your guests to comment
on
how that impacted their decision in addition to the high cost of their very sick members.
Sarah, thanks for that call. And Tom, yeah, people have been making the case. This isn't just about the bottom line. This was, people have used the word extortion, saying that because this merger wasn't approved, that's why Aetna's pulling out. Do you have thoughts or observations on that?
Well, that is certainly a discussion that's out there. I don't have firsthand evidence one way or another, but it's very clear that two of the very largest healthcare companies in America wanted to get even larger as one. And that is on the table in terms of appearing to be financially not doing as well as you might be, so that the chances of having the merger approved have a greater chance of going through. So, Sarah, I think you're right that that is something that's certainly lurking behind the scenes, and whether this is mostly a bluff or politics or whether this is a legitimate business practice of Aetna's part is, I think, in the mind of the beholder at this point.
Sarah, thanks for that call. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act and the latest on it with Tom Oliver from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Back to our callers with Jane on the line in Green Bay. Jane, hi.
Hi. I'm really glad, too, that you're having this topic on.
My husband and I are both self-employed, so we don't have the option of having a corporation insure us. So we do rely on the exchange. And I have a couple comments. We had United Healthcare for a year, and their ability to process claims was utterly unbelievably bad. We had things like a simple blood draw, $3.95, and it would take 10 times back and forth to get them to include it as a standard procedure, as an example. And then the other thing I wanted, so it doesn't surprise me that they're not making any money, you know, when you have that level of increase in the cost to administer a plan, I don't know how they would make money. And then the other thing had to do with the subsidies, which is the general overall view of things. We are really happy with the level of subsidies, but the uncertainty is really hard.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. So for her first question, Tom, I mean, we saw the trouble with the rollout from the government side. Is there a case to be made that some of these companies took on this big market and maybe bit off more than they could chew, and bureaucratic snafus were one of the results?
Well, I think change is when you're moving people from one level of coverage or one kind of plan into another. That is one of the problems with our fragmented health system, is that it's difficult to keep track of people. Our records, both administratively and the medical records, don't travel with us. And there's a lot of high overhead especially in the private health insurance world because of this. And then there's, of course, the intentional not paying and making, you know, putting the hassle factor on providers to get their payments or on beneficiaries to make sure that their bills are paid. So I think this is just one of those issues that is going to have to work its way out, and over time we'll end up with a more stable and reliable group of health plans in the exchanges. And then the final thing, Jane, you've got a really challenging situation because you don't have a larger employer contributing. It's good to hear that you feel the subsidies are fair. They're not supposed to be more than 9.5% of family household income, which is still a lot of money. But in the long run, I think what we're going to see is that individuals like that are going to, you know, have to, you know, keep pushing the government on this question of affordability, and then making sure that the health plans are responsive. But I think we'll see fewer and fewer health plans that are more and more reliable as we go on through time, or else there'll be a lot of pressure to create a public option so that the government itself is just paying directly to the providers and there's not a lot of claims processing.
Jane, thanks for that call. Tom, as we wrap up, what indicators are you watching for the well-being of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, let's put this in perspective. All of this is hullabaloo is over about 4% of state residents here in the state of Wisconsin, and relatively similar percentages across the country. There's so many more people enrolled in the Medicare program, many, many times more enrolled in children's health insurance and Medicaid, and employer plans, you know, dwarf this. So this is, you know, something that needs to work in the long run because it is filling in where other programs aren't available. But it's not as though the entire Affordable Care Act is in trouble or unraveling. In fact, it has performed very well. Millions and millions more have gotten coverage under the Medicaid and children's health insurance in the last few years. And in the long run, I think we're going to have to keep, you know, struggling to make sure these programs are seamless and we get everybody taken care of one way or another. The one thing that people don't realize with the Affordable Care Act is that it massively expanded the community health centers program.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Tom Oliver, professor of population health science at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health.